Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on Syria, where the Assad dictatorship has just warned that the region will go up in flames if the regime is threatened by what it calls Western interference. A specialist on Syria, James Galvin, joins us to assess where the real opposition, the Syrian people, are heading in terms of armed resistance supplanting peaceful protest, since thousands of unarmed citizens have been killed by a regime that is prepared to cling to power at any cost. Then we'll be joined by former constitutional and civil rights litigator and contributing writer to Salon, Glenn Greenwald, the author of With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. We will discuss the two-tiered system of justice in this country that protects the powerful and punishes the powerless, and how the uprising by the 99% is the first step in reversing a complete takeover of America by oligarchs. And joining us now is James Galvin, who is a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his forthcoming book, From Modernization to Globalization, The United States, the Middle East, and the World Economy in the 20th Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And it seems that in an interview with the UK's Sunday Telegraph newspaper, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has warned of an earthquake if the West intervenes in his country, which the West is intervening is apparently dubious and certainly being exaggerated on his part. I mean, most Western observers and would, I think, argue that the West hasn't intervened enough, that he's that Assad is able to go and murder his own people unabated. However, what was implied in what Assad was saying is that the country will be turned into another Afghanistan, and that the whole region, Syria is the hub now in this region. It is the fault line. If you play with the ground, you will cause an earthquake. Any problem in Syria will burn the whole region. So is this what he's saying now, is that he's saying, if you bring me down, I'll bring the whole house down?
Well, I think it's slightly different from that. I think what he's, number one, what he's saying is he's making a warning. He's always presented what's going on in Syria as either something that is between the Syrian people and Salafis, radical Islamists on the one hand, or gangs, and also between Syria and foreign intervention. At various points, it's been the Americans, it's been the Israelis, it's been the Saudis, it's been a whole variety of groupings. It's actually interesting to have a conspiracy that consists of both the Israelis, the Saudis, and the Palestinians at the same time. Nevertheless, he's tried to juggle that one as well. So it's one of those things where right now what he is attempting to do is to maintain his credibility in terms of being at the forefront of the anti-imperialist alliance, as he puts it, against the Americans, against the Saudis, who are the lapdogs of the Americans, against the Israelis, and so on and so forth.
Well, but isn't the from the very beginning when this outbreak, which I guess is obviously in obviously affected by the broader issues in the Middle East, and particularly the rise of the Arab Spring. It started in the most working class of towns, Diriyah, on the border with Lebanon, and it spread throughout the country. And it seems entirely to do with the Syrian people being fed up with over 40 years of this family who think they own the damn place.
Oh, you're absolutely right. The spark that set off the rebellion in Dara, it was the arrest of school children who had been writing graffiti, anti-regime graffiti, that had been borrowed, actually. The slogans had been borrowed from the Egyptian uprising. They were arrested. The parents tried to get them out of jail. It took 2 weeks. They still couldn't get them out. They were tortured while in jail. And the parents went out on the streets. That was it. You know, a week before this occurred, social networking-type youth in Damascus were unable to get more than 350 people out in a demonstration. once this thing occurred in Daraa, once the police once fired on the crowd in Daraa, you had 20,000 people out on the street of the small town, small border town, which is not nearly the size of the larger towns that right now are involved in the sort of uprising, like Homs and Hama.
Well, it spread, and it apparently the more Bashar al-Assad and his son, his brother Maher, who runs the 4th Division and the Republican Guard, who are doing most of the killing, it's sectarian in the sense that the Alawite regime that the Assad family represents, 15% of the country, it's a Shia, it's a branch of Shiism, and they control the military, they control the intelligence service, and they basically have locked down the entire military. But they've killed at least 3,000. You could, who knows what the real figure is? Most of the Syrian activists say it's much, much higher than that. And the more they kill, it seems the more that they bring the people out. I'm trying to get a sense of that dynamic because, you know, in our earlier hour, James Galvin, we were essentially talking about how maybe the people in this country are waking up in terms of the 99% movement. But we, you know, our politics are pretty pathetic and pretty passive, and you can't even get people to vote. These people are literally risking their lives. They're going out facing tanks and machine guns and the most brutal, heartless people who are literally prepared to, you know, they kill them at funerals, for God's sake.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, there are two things that I found astonishing about this uprising in Syria. The first one is the fact that the regime, in spite of being two steps behind every instance, has been able to maintain itself. The second one is the incredible heroism of the people who know what they're going to, what they're in store for when they go out on the streets. They develop tactics, for example, in order to get around what the government does. For example, they plan demonstrations for night so that government snipers are less likely to be able to pick them off one by one. I mean, things like that. So it really is absolutely astonishing watching what's going on there. The regime has said over and over again that it will not show any mercy to these gangs and Salafists and foreign agents that are supposedly the ones behind it. And the regime has not shown any mercy.
Well, it seems, though, that it's morphing into an armed struggle because people simply can't you peacefully demonstrate, they'll shoot you down. So obviously people are thinking, well, you know, we've got to arm ourselves. And apparently there have been some defections from the military, even though the Alawite officer corps controls the military and has locked down the army largely. There looks like there have been a number of deserters have managed to get away with some arms. And I'm wondering now that the Turks are offering a kind of safe haven inside their territory in the north of Syria, whether we're going to have a situation where you're going to have cross-border infiltration and you know, arms seeping in from Lebanon, from Iraq, where there's a lot of sympathy in the Anbar province, the Sunni areas, and from Turkey.
Yes, it's already been happening. Whereas you have people from the military defecting with their arms, you also have people from the military defecting without arms. And it's been the smuggling over the borders that has enabled the armed resistance to begin and actually accelerate. What we're seeing over time is a movement that was very flexible, unorganized, and peaceful. It's now settling into something very, very different. It's settling now into a sectarian conflict, and it's settling into a armed conflict. Now, of course, this couldn't be helped. I mean, at the very beginning, Bashar al-Assad said that this is what it was. This is how he was identifying it, sectarianism and through violence. But by maintaining the brutal repression, forcing or attempting to force Sunni conscripts to fire on their countrymen, what he's actually been able to do is to make it into a sectarian conflict, make it into an armed conflict. And so it was like a self-fulfilling prophecy there on his part.
Again, I'm speaking with James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA. He's a specialist on Syria. And we're talking about warnings and threats that the besieged dictator of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, family that had been running the country for what, for 43, is it, 42 years? I can't...
Hafez al-Assad came to power in 1970.
Well, I can't do the math right now, but it's a long time, right?
Yeah.
And there, the Arab League are meeting now in Qatar with Syrian members of the Syrian opposition and in the government. And the Chinese have issued public warnings. The Middle East envoy said that the situation cannot continue, call for Assad to respect and respond to the aspirations and rightful demands of the Syrian people. And even the Iranian regime, or at least a part of the Iranian regime, has criticized the Assad's handling of it. So, what's happening on the diplomatic front? Because the reality is that my understanding is, in spite of what Assad is saying, that the foreigners are interfering. That they're not. This is not another Libya, and there's no calls for. In fact, the opposition are calling for a no-fly zone, but there's nothing on the table, is there, in terms of Western interference?
No, there really isn't. There's several things that we have to look at. First of all, Libya was a perfect setup for a no-fly zone. It's a desert country. The cities are all in a line along the Mediterranean coast, and you could actually do something from the air. Syria is very, very different. It's a mountainous area. It's forested. It's not the sort of thing that you would want to try to enforce a no-fly zone over. There's that. What they're going for is, what the opposition is going for, is they think that if there is a no-fly zone, it's very, very possible that defections of people with military equipment will begin, tanks, armored personnel carriers, that sort of thing. That's what they're hoping for. If there is not a no-fly zone, then those defections could not take place because the Syrian Air Force could, of course, bomb any defectors from the air. So they're looking at it in that way. There is absolutely no reception for that in the West at this time. The United States is not going to intervene in Syria for a variety of reasons. But there's a great deal of pressure now being put on the Assad government to back off, on the one hand, and to enter into the national dialogue that the opposition is calling for. The national dialogue is the weeny way that the Americans have been going for every single one of these uprisings that have taken place since the Egyptian one. The idea that you could sit down with the opposition and hammer something out. The idea that maybe Bashar al-Assad could compromise in a way that would not continue the bloodletting and so on and so forth. It's not a real effective solution.
Well, if these talks, are they people that are talking in Qatar with the Arab League that represent the Syrian opposition? Do they really represent the Syrian opposition? Because Assad has his kind of token opposition that, as kind of tools, doesn't he?
Yes. First of all, the opposition is very disparate. It consists of a whole variety of political groupings, including the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, including the people that we associate with the uprisings, the human rights and pro-democracy groupings, including some, people from ethnic minorities like the Kurds and so on and so forth. It's very, very disparate. The fact that they've been able to get together at all is surprising. It's not surprising that they haven't been able to really pull together a very, very strong united voice because they are so different from each other in their aspirations. So there are members of the opposition who are seeking reform. There are other members of the opposition who are saying that the regime right now has too much blood on its hands to even sit down and attempt to talk to. And then there are others as well who just don't want to get sucked into this thing because they view it as, number one, a way that the regime will try to split the opposition, number two, a way that the regime can continue to stall while it continues to crack down on the opposition, and they also see that the regime, it's impossible for the regime to heal itself.
So, I don't understand I've never understood why the U.S. has been so cautious about this situation, and the Israelis too, in spite of Assad saying that it's that there are foreign powers intervening, and he obviously refers to both the United States and Israel. I don't think there's any evidence that they are. Now, what's happening in terms of the squeezing the business class, who the nomenklatura, I mean, the people that demonstrate for in the pro-government people, are a lot of them are just government workers in, who are told to come out and demonstrate, otherwise they won't get paid. You do have a financial elite that's largely controlled by the family. They've stolen most of it, but I guess there's some trickle-down operating. There have been some sanctions on the export of oil, but my understanding is that Shell Oil hasn't come on board to really put the squeeze on. Is that true?
Well, oil is a sector that is fairly isolated from other sectors of the economy. And the money from oil, of course, goes directly into the government's hands.
Which means it goes into the family's hands.
Right.
There's
right.
no distinction
and,
between
but it's
them.
Not just the family, because you know what we have is one of the reasons this family has been able to hold on for as long as it has been.
42 years.
Yep. Okay.
I did the math.
It does cross sectarian alliances as well as intra-sectarian power grab. So what you have is at the heart of the regime, you have an Alawite religious minority, many of them linked also in terms of kinship ties. And then spreading out from that, they've been able to build bridges to, for example, both the Christian and the Sunni merchant classes. And those bridges have allowed them to maintain, let's say, a broader base than one would expect from just a single minority sect ruling. Look at it this way. In 1982, the Muslim Brotherhood of Syria staged an uprising in the city of Hama. People focus on the bloodthirstiness of the regime in putting down that uprising. I mean, that was it really was bloodthirsty. They just shelled the city from the outside. But what people should also focus on is the fact that in spite of the uprising, in spite of the fact that the regime was a minority regime, nobody else went out. In other words, the city of Hama was the rebellion was isolated to the city of Hama. That, for example, elites among in the Sunni community in Damascus and Aleppo decided that they were going to side with the regime against the Brotherhood. So they have been fairly effective, the regime, in building this cross-sectarian alliance.
Right, but when Assad took over and his brother, who lives very comfortably in London, I might add, who was responsible for the massacre in Hama of something like 20,000 to 30,000 people, that was a period, of course, when things were very tense with Israel, right? With the Yom Kippur War took place shortly around the same time, didn't it?
Well, it took place about 10 years before. Yeah. It was very tense with Israel because it was the invasion of Lebanon.
Sorry, that's what was going on. Yeah.
In 1982.
Right.
But there was something else in the wider area that was going on as well, which we haven't seen much of recently, which is in the 1980s. The 1980s was the decade of Islamist violence. We're not talking al-Qaeda here. We're talking about organized Islamist parties that tried to overthrow the various governments in the region. The effectiveness of these governments in putting that down cannot be overstated. I mean, at this point, for example, most of the large parties that we have, Islamist parties throughout the Middle East, have either committed themselves to working within the system or have dropped out of politics altogether. We don't have the same sort of armed rebellions that we had, for example, in Egypt or in Syria or throughout the region during the 1980s.
But my understanding, though, is that this situation now with Syria and with Assad sort of basically warning that he'll tear the whole region apart if he goes down, would it be in response to the fact that to some extent it is a surrogate war? If the U.S. and Israel are sort of taking a hands off because they don't quite know what to do and they're probably afraid that an Islamist regime may end up running the place, Nevertheless, the Saudis have made it clear whose side they're on, and they're on the side of the rebellion. The Iranians have made it real clear whose side they're on. They're on the side of the Assad, so they've propped them up with billions in cash, and they've sent in their Revolutionary Guard units to help them beat up the people and kill the people, and also control the internet, which is apparently the Iranian IRGC learned from crushing the Velvet Revolution. They learned how to frustrate attempts at social networking that were so successful in the Egyptian uprising. And that seems to be what's going on in Syria. So how far are we already in terms of a surrogate war? And I would think with the Turks offering a safe haven for the military defectors and people that are escaping from Assad, you've got Saudis, obviously they can spend any amounts of money on arms, etc. Isn't this thing shaping into a kind of surrogate war?
I think there might be another way of looking at it, which is that part of the Iranian government has come out and condemned the Assads for what they're doing. The Chinese have done this. The Saudis have done this. None of these governments are particularly interested in human rights or democracy. They're hedging their bets. They don't know quite which way it's going to fall. They don't want to sever their ties with the Syrian government should they come out strongly on the side of Assad, for example, and Assad subsequently falls to some sort of organized opposition. So what they're trying to do now is they're trying to figure out exactly where to go with a foot in both camps. So they're warning Assad against the brutality, against crushing the rebellion. They're warning Assad about, perhaps moving towards the Syrian National Council and recognizing that as a potential government. But at the same time, they're not going to take active steps. The most active thing that has gone on right now has been what's going on with Turkey and providing a safe haven for military deserters. We don't know how far that's going to go, though, what the Turks are liable to do in those terms. For example, very early on, there was large-scale refugee movement into Turkey from Syria, and the Turks had a very, very, they made sure that, first of all, that the Syrians would be isolated on the border, maintain themselves on the border, not be able to move into Turkey in any real depth whatsoever. And they also kept them away from surrounding villages in southern Turkey as well. So we don't know exactly what they're trying to do, whether or not, for example, they're using this as a lever, a threat against the Syrian regime, or whether or not they're actually going to allow, for example, cross-border raids to take place.
Well, James Gelvin, I thank you for joining us and filling us in. It seems to me that this is the next showdown, if you will, now that Libya's over, and I'm sure I know the Libyan opposition is saying that now that Gaddafi's gone, you're next, Bashar. And it does feel like it's turning into the very thing that that Assad warned about.
Right. The one thing, just very, very briefly, the ending in Libya is not going to be the Syrian ending. Libya split. Every institution, the military, for example, between the opposition and the government. In Syria, it's not going to work that way. If the army continues its defections, it's not going to come from the officer corps. The officer corps is not going to split. It's going to be the head and the body. The body's going to split off from the head.
I thank you for joining us,
James
Gelvin. Again, I've been speaking with James Gelvin, professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, and the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and a forthcoming book, From Modernization to Globalization, The United States, the Middle East, and the World Economy in the 20th Century. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment and joined by Glenn Greenwald.
يا بشار 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 يا ب
Joining us now is Glenn Greenwald, former constitutional civil rights litigator, currently contributing writer at Salon.com, the author of two New York Times best-selling books on the Bush administration's executive power and foreign policy abuses. He's just released a book with Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful, a scathing indictment of America's two-tiered system of justice. He's also the recipient of the first annual I.F. Stone Award for Independent Journalism. Thank you so much for joining us on Background Briefing, Glenn Greenwald.
My pleasure.
And I guess if you go back to the beginning of this foundation of this country, which you do in the book, in terms of the founding fathers, they originally sort of envisioned the country, I guess, as a timocracy, the rule of those with property. But it's clearly evolved into more of a democracy. But it also seems to be at this point a democracy that coexists, albeit in a very awkward and uneven way with a oligarchy. So are we both a democracy and an oligarchy?
Well, I think the views of the founders on that question are somewhat complicated in the sense that they certainly believe that substantial income and wealth inequality would be not only inevitable but desirable. And, of course, that's not hard to understand, given that they were among the wealthiest individuals in that society. So they certainly wanted and admired a society that would produce large amounts of wealth inequality. There are a couple exceptions. Thomas Paine certainly viewed the wealthy as being sort of decadent. But in general, that's what they believe. But they were very clear about the fact that that inequality would be justifiable and legitimate only if it were grounded in a system under law where we were all bound by the same rules, so that the outcome inequality was justifiable and the byproduct of merit and what was deserved. And if, they virtually all argued, we abandoned that notion and allowed the wealthy to use their wealth to infect the legal and political system with severe amounts of inequality, then those outcome inequalities would be unjustifiable. So I think they envisioned a republic and a democracy, at least in terms of the principles that they espoused. They obviously violated them in lots of important ways, but in terms of the principles they espoused, I think that's what they have, that's what they envisioned and advocated, and I think what we have now is an oligarchy precisely because we've abandoned that vision, and we have allowed all of that wealth inequality to infect and shape the legal and political systems.
Well, it would seem that we have actually the worst of what Tom Paine railed against, which is counterfeit nobles, in the sense that the people on Wall Street are about extracting wealth, not creating wealth, and that they took the entire global economy into a near-death experience. They were bailed out by the taxpayer. They've been made whole. They have absolutely no gratitude. In fact, they seem to have contempt for the average people, in particular people demonstrating on the streets below them. And what they do seems to be kind of counterfeit.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, this is, you know, the Thomas Paine talked about, in contrast to counterfeit nobles, which is the aristocracy of Britain under the king, who were protected by their privileged legal status and were therefore counterfeit, and Paine heaped great scorn on them. He also talked about the natural aristocracy, people like Plato or Aristotle or Socrates, who achieved their high position through accomplishment and merit. And he was perfectly eager to accept the latter and not the former. And yet that would happen only if, as I said earlier, the legal system made a start on the same starting line, to use an analogy of a running race, and abide by the same rules so that whoever crossed the finish line first was really the fastest and deserved to win. And that's exactly what we don't have. And so you're right, we do have the worst of all worlds, and the reason for that is that the financial elites know that if they cheat and engage in pilfering and plundering and even commit massive fraud, as they did over the last decade, they will be shielded from all accountability and consequence. And when you tell them that, or when you tell political elites that they can commit crimes with pure impunity, what you're doing is you're guaranteeing that they will engage in criminal conduct because you've removed the deterrence against it.
So does that mean then, I want to get off the history, but does that mean, Glenn Greenwald, that we are that we both have a oligarchy and a meritocracy, or that would seem to be mutually exclusive?
Well, I think we were intended to have a meritocracy, and we don't, and therefore we have an oligarchy. And what's interesting is, you know, just in terms of that distinction, you know, I think that there's been a lot of talk, for example, about what has motivated the extreme levels of citizen outrage against the political institutions and both parties and all political leaders and the like, or even the protest movements like we see with the Occupy protest movement. And for some time, there was a suggestion that this protest movement was about anger over large amounts of inequality. And I never thought that that was true, because we've had large amounts of inequality for several decades. It's been exploding for several decades. And I think Americans are basically inculcated to agree with and accept inequality if they believe it's justified and legitimate. So, for example, when Steve Jobs died, he died with $8 billion. And I don't think very many Americans begrudge that, even though the country was suffering from mass joblessness and foreclosures, because of a perception that it was deserved and that he earned it. But the perception now exists that the winners in this system are not people who abide by rules or who produce things for the common good, but are people who cheat and defraud and pilfer and then use their wealth to shield themselves from accountability. And therefore, these inequalities have become illegitimate. So it's not the mere existence of inequality that has led to all this anger and these protests, but the perception that it's illegitimate, that it's not grounded in meritocracy, but is instead an oligarchy ruled by the wealthy. And I think that's what's really spurring most of the unrest.
Again, I'm speaking with Glenn Greenwald, who's a new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Glenn Greenwald, if the political energy is on the right, as the Tea Party indicated, and that was obviously a phony populist movement, an astroturf movement, if you will, that was guided by political pros like Karl Rove and Dick Armey, but they did that translated into 60 House seats. And they're working assiduously to win the next election, the Republicans. If the left abdicates, that doesn't that cede the entire field to the Republicans, and won't we have a one-party state in 2012?
Well, I guess there are a lot of people who believe that we have a one-party state, whether the Democrats or the Republicans win. So, for example, I was, you know, writing a great deal about things like warrantless eavesdropping and detention without charges and radical secrecy and presidential assertions of power to target people for death around the world without due process during the Bush years. And I remember very distinctly Democrats feigning anger over these things, and President Obama vowing to uproot them if he won. And then people, not just me, but many others, watched as the Democrats not only won the White House, but both houses of Congress. And these policies not only continued, but in many cases were strengthened and accelerated under a Democratic administration. I think the same thing happened on the domestic front, where President Obama vowed to change the way Washington works and to take the power away from the permanent factions who run Washington and reinvigorate the American people in terms of the way Washington responds to them. And then the first thing that he did was get into power and negotiate a health care bill in secret with lobbyists from those industries. Or act to ensure that Wall Street and the securities industry boomed and thrived at exactly the same time that mass joblessness and foreclosures persisted and even grew. And so, you know, I think that one of the problems that the Democrats are having in terms of avoiding the situation that you just described and motivating their own voters the way Republican voters are motivated, is that they already convinced people in 2008 that if they worked and devoted their money and their time to electing a Democrat in the White House and in Congress, that things would be substantially different. And people did it and believed, and they put their cynicism to the side, and they saw that even though they won, that very little of that happened, and a lot of things got worse. And so there's a lot of cynicism and a lot of skepticism on the part of Democratic voters about whether or not it's even worthwhile to care, or whether or not their interest and their resources and energies are better devoted to working outside of the system rather than simply keeping the Democratic Party in power.
Again, I'm speaking with Glenn Greenwald, the author of the new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Well, at least one Democrat, Dick Durbin in the United States Senate, blurted out in 2009 that the Senate, that basically he said, frankly, the banks own the place.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, when you talk about the lesser of two evils, which has been the unfortunate choice that we've had mostly in this political duopoly for the longest time, you know, I mean, I don't want to waste time passing out who was the most evil of the evil, the lesser of the two evils. It does seem that one may be incompetent and have failed, but the other one seems to be quite malicious in terms of its war on working Americans and the middle class, wanting to take away what little we have left of a social safety net, Medicare and Social Security. And, you know, the other one, of course, is apparently all too ready to cede a lot of the ground that we've gained throughout the these periods of oscillations between the power of the people and the power of the oligarchs. One of the starkest things in your book With Liberty and Justice for Some brings this out, and it sort of resonates with the 99% movement is the extent to which we have this shameful distinction of having more people in jail than any other country on the face of the earth, and a higher percentage of our citizens in jail than any other country on the face of the earth, and that includes some extremely unsavory regimes. Conversely, not one person has gone to jail for Wall Street. Do you think that there is any sympathy for the constituency where we warehouse generations of young men, particularly minority men?
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's a growing sense that some of our criminal justice policies that are applied to ordinary Americans are at least counterproductive and to some extent even unfair and oppressive. We incarcerate people for offenses that are too trivial and minor to be met with prison terms in most Western countries around the world. We put them there for longer periods of time and with fewer options of relief and with less mercy than almost every Western country. A substantial part of that is the drug war, which I think Americans more and more, polls show, are coming to oppose, at least when it comes to things like marijuana. And that is, you know, once you start questioning putting people into prison for marijuana consumption or buying and selling, then the rest of the policy becomes called into question as well. And then there's an issue that we just can't afford it any longer. I mean, prisons eat up a huge part of state and local budgets. And what's amazing about it is that if you talk to somebody about why we put people into prison for the use of drugs, what they'll say is, well, because drugs destroy families and they destroy individual lives. And yet nothing destroys families and individual lives more than taking somebody with a drug problem and turning them into a criminal and taking them away from their families and putting them into a cage for a year or 5 years or 10 years and calling them a felon and preventing them from working. I mean, nothing is destroying our communities more than these oppressive penal policies. And so I think you do see a lot more questioning about these things than you ever did before. The problem is that in America, we tend to have a very good versus evil, hero versus villain means of understanding political debates. And so once somebody is deemed to be a criminal, sort of like the way they're deemed to be a terrorist, we have this attitude, well, whatever happens to them is their own doing and we don't really care, and anything that's done to them is justifiable. And that is a very difficult bias to overcome in terms of getting people to understand why it's in the society's interest not to have this massive, sprawling, extremely expensive and oppressive penal state. But I think we do see some greater debate and attention being paid to it.
Well, one of the byproducts of this dysfunction in the war on drugs, of course, is that the country to the south, our neighbor Mexico, is essentially poised to become a failed state. It's so destabilized by the demand for drugs here in the United States, the denial that we have we are part of the problem. It's actually our money that's fueling the mayhem in Mexico. And, of course, because of our lax gun laws, weaponry flows down there unabated. So do you think the wake-up could come next door, from next door?
Well, what's so interesting about that is we learned these lessons before so clearly. I mean, you can almost find nobody who believes that returning to the era of prohibition in terms of alcohol is a good idea. I mean, people know that when you criminalized alcohol, you didn't really reduce the amount of alcohol consumption. What you did was drive it underground, and you created a huge industry of criminals and criminal gangs and mafia profits as a result of prohibition on alcohol, and that was why the country fairly quickly abandoned it. And yet exactly the same mistakes are being made now with prohibition of drugs. And, you know, one of the problems with all of these drug debates is, I mean, a big part of why there's so much violence in Mexico and now spilling over the border is precisely because we criminalize it and treat it as a war. And so the only people who are selling it are people who are criminals. And at the same time, the criminalization scheme keeps profits high, prices high, and therefore profits high. And it really is what fuels these cartels. And it's really, in an irrational world, concerns over violence in Mexico and the drug war in Mexico should be leading us to abandon criminalization schemes and the drug war. The problem is the more people perceive that there are problems associated with drugs, the more they support the drug war based on the false premise that the drug war decreases drug usage. And by the more we support the drug war, the worse these problems become. And it's just sort of this vicious cycle that needs to be broken if rational policies are to prevail.
Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Glenn Greenwald. So, Glenn Greenwald, you wrote the book With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Presumably, it's a kind of creed de coeur to get this country back on track and to restore a government of the people, by the people, for the people, and restore social justice, not to mention economic fairness. You spent a lot of time in Brazil, which is an emerging new power, arguably, you know, we're in retreat. And nobody destroyed America's hegemony more than George W. Bush. And that 8-year reign of misrule has really reduced America's standing, both economically, politically, geopolitically, et cetera. Now, on the other hand, Brazil is on a roll. The Brazilians and the Chinese may end up having to bail out Europe so that they can keep their markets open. But it's not a country without social problems. What's the difference there? It seems to me that in the Brazilian culture and in terms of their national pride, there's a social contract in a sense that things are getting better and that there's a fairness out there. How would you, since you live in both countries, how would you describe and differentiate the two?
Well, it's really incredible. The two countries, Brazil and the United States, are about as opposite as can be in terms of the tracks that they're on. So, you know, if you went to Brazil 10 years ago, you saw a country that had an enormous rich-poor gap, a virtually non-existent middle class, a perception that the country was rife with corruption, pessimism about the future, contempt for their political class. And what you now have is the opposite. You have a booming middle class, amazing economic growth. The last president, Lula, left office with 84% approval. 84%, that's inconceivable in the United States. And they very much perceive of themselves accurately as a country that is rapidly on the rise and that is becoming more powerful, that has more prosperity, that their children will have extraordinarily more opportunity than they had. You can see the middle class having been created very quickly. And of course, in the United States, you have exactly the opposite perception. For the first time in our nation's history, huge numbers of Americans perceive that we are a nation on the decline. There is extreme levels of economic anxiety over the fact that our children will have less opportunity, will be poorer, will have harder lives than we've had, the exact reversal of the American dream. There's barely a middle class left. You're either extremely rich or working multiple jobs just to hang on and living paycheck to paycheck. And of course, Americans overwhelmingly hate their political class and believe that they're corrupt and ineffective. And a big part of the reason why is because the American system of government has been devoted to the interest of a small sliver of the country that has actually thrived at the expense of everybody else, whereas the Brazilian political system has been devoted to the opposite goal. They've been devoted to the goal of raising the opportunities and the prosperity for the vast majority of citizens and creating opportunities where none existed and prosperity where it was unimaginable to see it. And they're really two countries on completely opposite tracks for that reason.
So, Glenn Greenwald, what do you hope? Because we're offering up your book here in support of our radio station of this program with Liberty and Justice as Somehow the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. What do you hope? We've talked about the broader kind of zeitgeist where there's this nascent movement to take back America that's spontaneously erupted on Wall Street and spread across the country and around the world. I was just yesterday in a small town in Northern California, Petaluma, just driving through the main street, and there on the corner there was about 200 people with signs, "Down with greed." I mean, it was an extraordinary sight to see in small town America this sense of outrage. And this was a cross section of people. This wasn't anybody's, or particularly Fox News's idea of the usual suspects. Right. Give us a sense of what you feel that why you wrote the book. That in simple terms, why did you write the book?
I think the key to generating meaningful political change is to communicate the realities of political life in the country to one's fellow citizens and to try and motivate them to care more and to act. And I really, do believe that there is this inchoate sense that what is truly fundamentally wrong with our political culture, first and foremost, is that we no longer play by the same set of rules, that we don't really have a democracy, that if you are wealthy and powerful, the entire system is devoted to your interest to the point where you can even literally exempt yourself from the one area where we were supposed to have complete equality, and that's the law. And that has delegitimized all other forms of political life, and it's really destroyed the opportunity that has long been the hallmark of American life, the idea that if you work hard and achieve and produce, then you can improve your state and you'll have basic security. That's no longer the case. One of the things that you're able to do when you write a book is to take a step back from the normal day-to-day political debates and to devote a lot of thought and do a lot of research and try and highlight what the real causes are, what the real root problem is. The only reason for me to write a book, the only reason that I would ever write a book, is because I believe that there are important things that need to be said that aren't being said, and the book is an opportunity to say them. And the reason why one wants to say them is to tell one's fellow citizens, there are these severe and profound injustices that you don't have to accept and shouldn't accept. And there are movements right now underway. The Middle East taught this lesson, but we're teaching it to ourselves that even the most seemingly invulnerable power factions that are created by human beings can be replaced and torn down by other human beings if the will is there. And there's certainly a lot of reason to try, and there's lots of reason to think we can succeed. And, my writing this book was just my trying to play my part in helping that bring that about.
And Glenn Greenwald, we spoke earlier of the dubious distinction of having more people in jail than any other country, both in terms of the number and in terms of the in ratio to our population, and obviously to some extent that population is in jail for economic crimes, in as much as they can't get a job, and the jobs that are available may be associated with the crime. But just back to the 1% and the financial elite, The 2008 crash was a huge scam that was a Robin Hood in reverse, where they attracted a bunch of aspirants to the middle class, mostly minority people, to buy homes on fraudulent basis, traps in the small print. They ended up reaping enormous amounts of money, creating this bubble. Some of the smart people like Paulson, a hedge fund guy, bet against it. In other words, he bet that people would be kicked out of their homes and would have to be forced to live in their cars. That's the callousness on the part of the financial elite and how they've been reaped this enormous profits in this kind of Robin Hood in reverse. But if you use the law as a weapon to create more penury, I don't believe that we'll ever get back to debtor's prison. But in effect, I just heard on the radio today that the various states in this country, including the state of Idaho, apparently have laws now that if your house is foreclosed on, you can't walk away, that you in fact are indebted. And you have to pay that off, and that they're going after people, and the banks are even selling these debts to kind of collection agencies. So do you think that there's a possibility that the capture of the law by the elite, who don't abide by any kind of moral principles that are recognizable, but can get away whether they can get away with murder, I'm not sure, but they can sort of say get away with theft. What about the notion that they will shackle us with the detritus of their own wreckage?
I mean, that's the, you know, this is the main problem, is that when you have the ability of elites to shield themselves from the law and only everyone else is subjected to it, that law ceases to become a guarantor of equality, and it becomes a weapon in the hands of the powerful to maintain social control and entrench their own power. And you see this in all kinds of ways. You see people who are in power who commit serious crimes being exempt from consequences, and yet the Obama administration is waging a vast war on whistleblowers. People who expose government wrongdoing and improprieties being prosecuted with great vengeance. Or you see Wall Street criminals who have suffered no investigations or consequences for their massive theft, and yet at the same time the law has changed, so special courts are created to make foreclosures much, much easier to finalize and take away people's homes. And this is really using law as exactly the opposite of what it was intended to be, which is a weapon in the hands of those who are most powerful. And, you know, there's an interesting article by Simon Johnson, who is the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, in 2009 in The Atlantic. And one of the reasons it's interesting is because it used to be that the kind of conversation that you and I are having would be consigned to sort of the radical and fringe realms of dissent. I mean, the idea of talking about the United States as an oligarchy or as a lawless state would be something that most people would sort of recoil at. And yet now it's so glaring that it has entered into mainstream discourse. So we can read in the New York Times, Nicholas Kristof, a columnist there, routinely describing America as a banana republic or a third world country, and he should know since he travels around the world all the time in those countries. And Simon Johnson wrote this article, even though he's the former chief economist of the IMF, as mainstream a position as it gets, and it was called The Quiet Coup. And the word coup in his article refers to the fact that the nation's elite, financial elite, have taken over control of the United States. And what he said is that in his experience at the IMF, he worked on financial crises and collapses in emerging market governments and developing countries like Argentina and Russia immediately after the fall of communism, and in Eastern European states and other South American states. And he said that what would happen there is that whenever there was a financial collapse caused by the corruption of elites, those financial elites would use their control over the government to make sure that the government acted to protect them, the ones who caused the crisis, at the expense of everybody else, and taking as much as possible from the average citizen to protect the elites and shield their interests from harm. And he said this goes on until essentially people in the streets decide that they're no longer willing to tolerate it. And that is exactly, he says, what has happened in the United States, that the use of their control over law and politics has meant that they shield themselves and protect their own interests at the expense of everybody else's and saddle us with their burden and with their debt. And I think that's exactly what you see in the United States. And it's acknowledged not just by people like us, but in the most people who have spent their lives working in the most mainstream institutions.
So just in closing then, Glenn Greenwald, do you think that we've already discussed the notion that there is a some kind of backlash underway. We're not quite sure where it's heading, but we know what it's in response to. Just looking at the faces that were demonstrating yesterday in the small town that I drove through, the idea that average Americans are outraged by this sense of betrayal to the kind of mythology of that we're a meritocracy and an egalitarian society, and that things just aren't fair anymore. So do you think that the wedge issue here is fairness?
I really do. I actually wrote an article last week in which I made the argument that what I believe is motivating the Occupy movement specifically in citizen anger generally is not that Americans have suddenly rejected the virtue or desirability of wealth inequality. I think Americans are sufficiently inculcated, for better or worse, to believe that wealth inequality is something that's justifiable as long as it's fair. I think that what's motivating it is the sense that it no longer is fair, that the people against whom they're protesting are not simply wealthy, but are cheaters, thieves. And that the politicians who are there to safeguard against that robbery are themselves captive to those same interests, if not as corrupt. And that it is the fact that the winners don't deserve their winnings, not that winning in general is illegitimate or wrong. And you see this, you know, this sense on the right, and you see it on the left, and you see it in across the spectrum. And I think a big part of it comes from the fact that Americans watched Wall Street tycoons engage in all kinds of oozing illegality and corruption, and not a single one of them have seen the inside of a courtroom. And that really was a triggering moment, signaling to Americans on whose behalf our government really works, and the mythology, as you called it, that we're in any way subjected to the same set of rules on a roughly equal basis.
Well, Glenn Greenwald, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Glenn Greenwald, who's a former constitutional and civil rights litigator and currently contributing writer at Salon.com. He's the author of two New York Times best-selling books on the Bush administration, executive power, and foreign policy abuses. His just-released book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful, is a scathing indictment of America's two-tiered system of justice. He is the recipient of the first annual I.F. Stone Award for Independent Journalism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.